This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Renegade University is growing fast. We've just added several new faculty who will be teaching courses on history, philosophy, political theory, and creative writing in the winter term. Over the next few weeks, we'll also be announcing several live in-person events and courses in cities across the country. But right now, we have two new webinars that are coming up soon. The first one is taught by the great Scott Horton, whose recent webinar on the history of the Afghanistan War was incredibly successful. Scott will be teaching a new webinar called The War on Terror, a Global Catastrophe. That'll be Wednesday, February 7th, 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And I will be teaching a webinar on the history of the relationship between the United States and the rest of the world in the 19th century. That's called Dangerous Nation, the United States and the World, 1776 to 1898. And that webinar will be offered on Monday, February 12th, 5:30 p.m. Pacific, 8:30 Eastern. You can get all the information and register for these courses at thaddeusrussell.com. The Founding Fathers argued that the family was the very foundation of American civilization, and that therefore the mother, who is at the center of the family, bears more responsibility than any other American citizen. Motherhood became sacred in American culture, and being a good mother became a woman's highest calling. But it turns out that being that kind of a good mother requires keeping secrets, lots of secrets. Good mothers don't say certain things. So I was amazed to discover one mother who's willing to say everything. This is my interview with Elisa Albert. So I drove all the way to Albany, New York to sit with this woman, Elisa Albert, who wrote this book. And first of all, I want to say, Elisa, that I have to apologize. I'm about 2.5 years late. Your book,
you're right on time.
I'm always right on time. It came out in 2015 and received incredibly positive, glowing, enthusiastic reviews pretty much everywhere. The New York Times, where else? You name it. You don't want to brag, I know. But I mean, it's one of those novels that kind of just was the novel. And a lot of people were talking about it and singing its praises. And that's sort of interesting that it got praised. In fact, that's that phenomenon itself, I think, is worth talking about. But it's called Afterbirth, and I'm sorry that it's, you know, I'm a little late here, but I did read it recently, and it completely wiped me out. Overwhelming, and it's amazing. And so here's the background, because people don't know what the hell I'm talking about, probably, because my audience probably hasn't read it.
Why would they? It's about, like, a woman, right?
It's about Jewish women having children.
That's not universal.
It's about motherhood.
Childbearing isn't universal.
Yeah. Yeah. None of my fans would ever care about something like that, which is maybe partly true. But
they don't want to think about that somebody gave birth to them.
Huh? Yeah. I know. So I was never a mother, and I was only a quarter Jewish, but a whole lot of it resonated with me. And because I was a dad, married to a mother who was Jewish, and we had a child in Brooklyn, which your narrator in the novel had moved from Brooklyn to a place that looks an awful lot like Albany, New York. And she's an academic, and her husband is an academic. And anyway, so when I was in Park Slope, Brooklyn, being the dad, you know, Park Slope is famously the world capital of moms. And in every way. Like they're everywhere. The moms themselves are everywhere. The children are everywhere. The strollers and the nannies, the West Indian nannies, who are the auxiliaries, of course. But more importantly, just the culture of it. It was a mom culture, up, down, back and forth. And I, on the one hand, I loved it because it's really pretty and nice. And the entire neighborhood is geared around children and parenting. So for a while, you know, when you're in the shit, like when it's just like the Vietnam War every day, and that's really what your book is about largely, is that period, the beginning after the child's born. It was good, I have to say. You know, if you're going to be in New York and you have a kid, you should probably do it in Park Slope because everybody's going through the same thing. And so everybody talks about the diapers and the throw up and the diaper genie. And I don't even know what they have now, but, you know, strollers and all that stuff. And so it's useful. It's really useful for a while, for a few months, maybe a year. And then you notice, if you're me or if you're Elisa Albert, I think, you notice that that's all anybody's fucking talking about. And it becomes like you realize you're living in the Stepford Moms movie. And at least for me, that was my experience. And this included my wife. I mean, that's all anybody ever talked about. And I noticed also, and I think you'll get what I'm talking about here because it's in your book, no one talks about sex. No one seemed to be having sex. Mm-mm. No one exhibited any sexual desire, men or women, by the way. I was hanging out with women and men, and I didn't hear anybody talk about it. And it was pretty clear the couples, there was no sex among the couples. So, and there was no sex in my marriage during that time.
There's like a deadening.
Right.
A sort of soul level kind of deadening.
Yeah.
It overtakes people if they're not careful.
Yeah, you call the mothers who go through that invisible. You say they become invisible. I think that's partly right. I think it's deeper than that. Yeah, they're dead. The bodies become dead. They lose their bodies.
I think that starts earlier. I think that's actually like symptomatic of what is wrong in our culture with childbearing. You know, childbearing in and of itself doesn't have to be deadening and doesn't have to be soul crushing, but the way that we're sort of programmed to think that we have to go about it requires us to disengage from our bodies. And that doesn't end well for anyone, you know?
Yeah. So people aren't understanding why I'm interviewing you yet. So,
okay. Sorry.
So this novel,
because I'm awesome.
You're writing. Yeah, you are. And it's, I wanted to quote you. In fact, so when I was reading it, my girlfriend currently, never had kids, and she's 48 and never wanted to have kids. And so she would go to parties with other women and they'd ask her, so when are you going to have kids? Or they'd say, God, that's so sad. Aren't you sad? Right. So as I was reading your novel, I was just cutting and pasting and texting section after section and saying, oh my God, can you believe this? So you talk about, oh, anyway, let me finish my story.
Okay.
This whole thing, I think, clarify it. So there's no sex. There's no talk of sex. There's constant talk about babies and diapers. And there's a whole world full of suffering that no one's really acknowledging. It's a world of secrets, and that's a word you use to describe it. People are clear, because I know, because I see, you know, just the physical agony, from the birth itself, even before the birth, but certainly during the birth itself, even if you don't have a C-section. It was just, I was in awe of the suffering that my wife went through, and it was a normal childbirth. It wasn't a C-section or anything. And then, of course, you know, when the kid comes out, you're basically, as I say, at war. You're really at war, and there is just supreme suffering that I had never experienced before, and I still can't even wrap my head around it. And it's funny, I've noticed that I think my mind kind of just has shut it out
because
it's so traumatic, I think, isn't that something that the minds often do?
Yeah.
PTSD, that's one form
just
of PTSD.
Pack it away.
But so I think I saw in the culture that I was in, which is a very particular culture, not all of the world or America even is Park Slope. Thank God, for real. But
no offense, Park Slope.
But like Freud would call it repression. You call it secrets. I would call it all those things. There was just no talking, really acknowledgement of really the depth. I mean, people would complain, but like the way you talk about it, it really reminded me of Vietnam War novels. That was the feeling I had.
Awesome.
Reading
that was the hope. I mean, that was how it was supposed to be, like a female war novel.
Oh, really?
This is a rite of passage. This is like what women go through. Not all women, but a lot of women. And in every generation, this is like a major rite of passage. We have wars in every generation. Huh. We have childbearing in every generation so far.
That's cool. I'm glad I got that right.
Yeah. War novel. Absolutely. Because we have this huge, vast literature of war.
Sure do.
And it's important, and it's life or death, and it's like has lasting repercussions, and it shapes the way that culture and the world move forward. But we have this enormous void around. Yeah.
So, but war, experience. You know, we may think it's noble, but everybody thinks it's traumatic, mm. right? There's no debate about that. And, you know, it's hard. You know,
some people get off on it, right?
Oh, totally. And sure, there's a lot of like romanticizing of it, but certainly in recent years, since the Vietnam War, like Vietnam war novels and movies have been, you know, pretty upfront about how it's, you know, really brutal and traumatic.
Right. Like photography has been really bad for war.
What? Oh, for war making.
Right. Like, yes. So since yes. the advent of photography, we can't really glorify war that much anymore. Right. Before photography, you can imagine how war might have been this amazing, mythological, triumphant, like yep. phantasmagoric
yeah,
experience.
Yeah, they screwed up by letting the photographers into the field in Vietnam. And that was the end of that war. But so, yeah, the feeling I get in reading your novel, it's funny. Anyway, so we've all known that it's traumatic to be a soldier in a war, but some of us have known that it's traumatic to be a mother. So yeah, mothers are at war.
With each and other, it, and it with feels, themselves.
Yeah, that's
with
part
their
of it.
Spouses, with their partners, with their children.
With their bodies.
That line in the New York Times review, the last line was freaking beautiful. It was, I don't know if I can quote it from memory, but Merritt Tierce is just such a spectacular writer in general. And it's something about like how it's a war for your heart, mind, body, and one that you can't stand for the other side to lose, you know,
right?
The other side being this precious,
yeah,
extraordinary creature you've brought forth from,
and as you say, existence. I think this is a line from your book: you're wedded to the possibility of extreme loss.
Right.
In other words, that's the thing you can't
right
lose to. Right. So I've never heard of anybody writing about motherhood the way that you do. Is there a precedent?
Adrienne Rich of Woman Born, 1972, just like the Bible. Like, I mean, she gets into things in such a way as only she can.
But does she write about it with such graphic detail?
She does. I mean, most of what she's doing is like anthropological, cultural, historical, and her kind of vast right. wealth of knowledge is pretty mind-blowing. But she then, you know, interspersed are personal anecdotes, and she talks about raising her three sons and feeling so shocked by the experience because nobody had ever really articulated to her what that meant. That, you know, as a woman, you're supposed to kind of just
right.
figure it out as you go, but it's like, and no one cares and no one's going to help you because it's like boring and, you know, it's like girl stuff, so who cares? But that if you're like kind of a thinking person, in addition to being a female, like you're going to feel like you ran into a brick wall at 100 miles an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an act of sedition, what you're doing, actually. Don't you think? Because the family, thoroughly important in this country, Elisa. So it's
right
kind
here.
Of the foundation they've been telling us. And I think they're right, essentially. It is. I think this civilization has been founded upon the nuclear family. And so, you know, within the nuclear family, you have to have a mother who's willing to go along, a good soldier.
Right.
Oh my God. And your narrator, his name is Ari, is not a good soldier. I mean, I guess she is in a sense. She's a good soldier who is letting herself know, at least, right? Mm-hmm. She's letting herself know that she's at war. And she's letting herself know everything that means. So you're listening to her speak to herself, I think. About every single detail and every gory, literally gory detail. The other thing I was going to tell you, it reminded me of, not just war novels, is so before my son was born, you know, I was well into my 30s when he was born. So my entire life, I hated horror movies and I just was scared of them in a way. And it just disgusted me and I didn't want to see them. He was born. And then about a year or two after he was born, I noticed that I was like watching horror movies, like the new ones too, not even like the classics. I just went straight for like Saw 2, Saw 3, and like, I forget the names of them, but it was just, you know, absolutely grotesque, gory, like scenes of evisceration, you know, and with like the new technology. So it really looked like they were pulling the guy's intestines out and plucking the eyeballs out. And I was like, wow, why do I all of a sudden find this very appealing? And I just it occurred to me when I was reading your novel that that may have not been a coincidence, that there was something it was telling me about what I was experiencing to some extent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't directly, of course.
It's like visceral, primal, and just, you know, body shit. Like what happens when, it, you know, birth and death are two ends of the spectrum and they're closer together than people want to think about. People don't want to think about death and people don't want to think about birth. They want to, you know, if they have to go through one or the other or both, they would rather it be sort of very compartmentalized, you know, mm-hmm. Let's not think about that. Let's not really experience that. That's just, you know, that's gross or that's upsetting or that's painful or that's, and so we contort ourselves in these great, great ways. By great, I mean awful, to sort of avoid having to kind of be in that and really look at it and really experience it. And I think we suffer ultimately more than we would if we could just kind of roll.
Huh. What do you mean roll?
If we were like practiced at dealing with these things, if birth wasn't something gross or awful or so upsetting that, you know, we have to just kind of mock it and avoid it or not really look at it. I mean, you know, once you start to see this stuff, you can't unsee it. Like everywhere in our culture, every TV show, every movie, birth scenes are a farce. They resemble very little an actual birth or a decent birth, you know, a birth that is happy and healthy for everyone involved. They're traumatic. They're disgusting. It's like, cut me open. Fuck this. Somebody faints. If somebody has to look directly at a vagina with a baby coming out of it, they like pass out and it's like easy laughs for everyone. It's just, it's a real twisted understanding of what that process actually is. And we just don't have that in our culture. We don't have a real clear understanding of like, here's what birth is. And like, it really is okay to look straight at. It's pretty awesome. And let's like be familiar with it.
Can I read from your book?
Please.
I know that's kind of weird. The author is supposed to read, but so here's what you don't see in American popular culture, right? Mm-hmm. In its descriptions of birth. So this is of a cesarean section. They cut me in half, pulled the baby from my numb, gaping, cauterized center. Merciless hospital lights, curtain in front of my face, effective disembodiment, smell of burning flesh, sewn back up again by a team of people I didn't know, none of whom bothered to look me in the eye, not even one of them, not even once, severed from hip to hip, iced, brutalized, catheterized, tethered to a bed, the tiny bird's heartfelt shrieks as they carted him off somewhere, hell itself. Yeah, you don't see that.
No.
You don't hear that. You don't read that. And that passage was pretty amazing to me. And it reminded me, I mean, I hope this you take this as a compliment because it's meant as one. It reminded me of the best horror fiction. And it's so upfront about the brutality of, you know, this ordinary thing that we don't talk about. I mean, that's what horror movies are good for, right? They kind of like expose these. They force us to look at stuff that we refuse to look at, that we compartmentalize, as you were saying.
Right. So Ari, this character, has had a, you know, what we would call a quote unquote bad birth, you know, not bad in that everybody didn't come out alive, bad in that it was really traumatic and dehumanizing.
Right.
And that is...
You mean especially dehumanizing? Because they're all sort of...
No. See, that's where...
Well, I mean, within the modern medical establishment, isn't that sort of an argument
I think
you're making?
Too often.
Yeah.
Too often.
Right.
They don't, the point is though, they don't have to be.
Right,
and
sure.
That's where this is kind of, you know, that's where the whole structure of what's going on in this country at this point in time and many other countries too, is a real crime against humanity and has its basis in like a real deep misogyny.
Hmm. Unpack that. What do you mean?
Well, the power to bring forth new life is pretty huge, and arguably it's what has so threatened patriarchy since time immemorial.
Why is it threatened patriarchy?
Because women are the only ones who have that power. So there's this idea, Adrienne Rich talks about this at length, that like the roots of misogyny are actually in a jealousy. That we have to control women because women are our only means of...
We need them.
I mean,
we depend on them to have our civilization, to have our patriarchy, right?
Right. So you can't have new life if you don't have women. So let's really severely restrict and control the movements and the, you know, behaviors of women so that we can control how humanity, you know, is able to go on.
Right. But why would they want to make birth especially traumatic?
Well, it hasn't always been. I mean, well, so, you know, this, the history of childbirth is its own thing. You know, until 150 years ago, there was no such thing as obstetrics. Mm-hmm. The father of modern obstetrics and gynecology was Dr. Marion Sims, who was basically the, like, Mengele of American slaves. He experimented basically with modern gynecological procedures
on
slave women.
Wow. Oh, on actual slaves.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and obviously without consent of any kind, did horrific, torturous things to them to see, like, what could be done. There's a statue of him in Central Park that I believe was just removed after many years of protesting.
I did not know this.
Dr. Marion Sims, the father of modern gynecology and obstetrics, a man named Marion, mind you. Anyway, so you look back at, you know, recorded history, and what do you see over and over again? You see midwives as villains,
right?
Witch hunts,
right?
There was always thought to be this kind of strange, suspicious, dark power that these knowledgeable women, the women who knew how to abort, the women who knew how to use herbs to stem postpartum bleeding, women who knew how to induce labor, women who knew how to deliver breech babies, women who knew how to deal with a lot of the life cycle of a female body. And that knowledge was kind of wiped out over and over and over and over again, as though it never existed. And now modern obstetrics and gynecology kind of pretends that it had never existed. You know, the idea that you can abort a baby using herbs is like, that's absurd. Like, why would you do that?
Of course, the obstetrics profession and the medical establishment as a whole was, of course, dominated by men until fairly recently. And so it would make sense that it would at least be less sensitive to the suffering and the experience that women would have in childbirth. That makes sense. Sure.
The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology was formed like with the explicit intent of wiping out midwifery. And they actually used like PR campaigns. I mean, they really advertised this, and it was like they had pictures of old, barefoot, dirty women saying, do you want some like gross old woman to deliver your baby, or do you want this beautiful, sterile, modern, privileged way? And it was Queen Victoria who originally said, I don't have to suffer in birth. I don't believe in that.
Yeah, but Elisa, here's what they were trying to do. They were professionalizing it, okay?
Right.
So there were amateurs butting in and in this very important process, and they were simply imposing standards. And that's what was going on in the medical profession. That was what was going on in the academic profession. That's what was going on in all the professions. I think you're talking about the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah,
I didn't know about that specifically. That's really interesting. It makes perfect sense, though, with the rest of the history I do know about. It's
right.
Part of that general process of kicking out the so-called amateurs and establishing the profession. There wasn't really a profession until then. And then with all these new rules and standards, and also with the end product, hopefully, the, as you said, sterile or perfect citizen.
Right. And it's like, and, you know, we can make birth fail safe. We can perfect it. You know, it's a dangerous process. I mean, women used to lose babies all the time.
Sure.
That's inarguable.
Yeah.
You know, we've made some progress. Like I would rather give birth here and now than, you know, 300 years ago. If there's something wrong, you know, it's nice that we can sort of look for issues. If there's an issue, there's a lot we can do. That's all fine. But for a woman with a healthy woman with a healthy pregnancy, giving birth within this system in the United States is like seriously dangerous. Problems will be caused.
Well, I mean, death rates have declined though, haven't they?
For
the mothers, right? It's declined. You're less likely to die
than what?
Giving birth 100 years ago. aren't you?
I haven't seen that data. I don't know what the data was from 100 years ago.
And I think well, it doesn't matter. I mean, it matters to some extent, but...
But if you look at data from, like, us compared to Holland, Sweden, Finland, et cetera, places where the first point of entry is a midwife. If you're pregnant, you go to a midwife. If there's a problem, a midwife can refer you to a pathologist, and you can hopefully have your problem addressed. But, you know, it's like you don't go to an oral surgeon for a teeth cleaning. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to a hygienist. If the hygienist says, oh, hey, there's something here... Let's move on up the, you know, the ladder here. Anyway, so our rates here, the maternal mortality in the U.S. is like rock bottom.
Well, I know the death rates in hospitals is crazy, mm-hmm. generally. I mean, for everything. It's in tens of thousands per year in the United States. People die because of mistakes made in hospitals. And I'm sure a lot of those are.
But just maternal mortality, we're 60th in the world.
Wow.
The United States, like our glorious, mm-hmm. you know, our glorious leading first world country.
So part of the issue, I think, is that it's a factory also, right? It's they're pumping out the babies. Right. That was certainly our experience. And by the way, I don't think a man touched or even talked to my wife the whole time. It was all women, doctors and nurses throughout. Right. But it felt like, and they weren't bad. They were fine. But it was, you know, I felt like. We were in line, it was a production line, an assembly line. And
well, it's supposed to standardize birth too. And the standardization is what makes it kind of dangerous.
There you go.
Because there's no two births that are alike.
That's right. No two mothers, no two women, no two people, no two babies who are alike.
Right.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I think you're describing here is the, you know, people who didn't know me mm-hmm. are telling me and doing things to me and I don't even know who they are and they're not even looking in my eyes. It's very impersonal. And I guess you don't really argue this in the book, but I guess it's implicit and you do argue it elsewhere, right? Mm-hmm. You're for natural childbirth, is this right? And midwifery and this, right? This alternative approach.
Yeah. I think obstetrics is an alternative approach. And I mean, I think that quote unquote natural is a difficult word because, you know,
believe me.
You know,
believe me. I have arguments pretty much every day about that word. But
I think physiological childbirth—the idea that physiological birth is beneficial to mothers and children and families and humanity—is kind of inarguable at this point. Like when we look at other countries, when we look at places where women are treated differently in birth, where women are cared for differently, where childbirth is normalized, where healthy mm-hmm. women with healthy pregnancies are treated. You know, not like invalids, not like broken, not like terrified. Things go better for everyone in every possible way.
Right. So this is definitely, I mean, I highlighted it. I read a piece of it. You know, this is one of the problems you write about in this book, having to do with motherhood, parenthood, child rearing, but it's only one of many. And in fact, I wouldn't even say it's the major problem that the narrator is dealing with. I mean, it's just an endless horror show in a way. And a lot of it's social, right? It's not mm-hmm. just about how she was treated in the hospital bed, but
I think they're connected. I mean, I hope it's making that point that that like this whole system is set up so that this woman, a healthy woman with a healthy pregnancy, was put through this, you know, disassembly line, basically mm-hmm. brutalized for no good reason, sent home alone, with a newborn and a kind of a sweet, well-intentioned but clueless husband.
See, that's where I think that's the real. That to me, that's the root of the problem.
But it's all, you know, we couldn't expect women to be sort of satisfied with this kind of treatment if we lived in the kind of culture where she would never go home alone with a baby. You know, it's like lacking this kind of like greater structure of support and of kind of the matrilineal sort of well-being of the family line and mm-hmm. sisters and cousins and friends and neighbors that like, you know, women not talking to each other, women's like that. I think the nuclear family is ultimately a lie and it's harmful.
What?
A lie.
Come on. That's radical.
I know. Sorry.
Yeah. I think you opened my eyes to the medical establishment. I hadn't really thought about it carefully enough and I didn't know the history, which I'm a little embarrassed about, but I'm really more just glad you told me about this.
It's cool stuff.
Yeah, but it also fits perfectly with what I do know about that era and establishment generally. But yeah, no, the nuclear family. So my God. Well, that's what immigrants do. Okay. First of all, You know, they bring, as you were saying, the sisters and the aunts and the cousins and grandma and grandpa, and they all help raise the child. And that's not what we do here.
Nope.
And it's never been what we do here. And there's a reason for that, which is that we are a country built upon the independence of individuals, which goes for the families. And even within the families, you're supposed to be somewhat independent. But if we are not independent as nuclear as families, as parents, then we're not going to raise independent, self-regulating citizens. Our children will become dependent wards of the state or something like that. So it's really important here, okay? For a couple, I know you're Jewish, so you don't fully get this, but like, you know, being a recent immigrant stock, but for more than 200 years in this country, that's how we've been running things. And I know that when your people got here originally, they brought all the family to raise the kids, but we trained them to get over that.
Totally. You got to Americanize us, man.
Yeah. So, you know,
none of that like nasty old country bullshit.
Yeah. No, it's, so that's to me, I mean, that's most, I think, of the narration. I mean, that's most of what the narrator's talking about is the isolation. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff going on, but like she's constantly, and literally, she's almost never speaking, by the way. It's almost all thoughts.
Right.
Right. So she's speaking mostly to herself.
Yeah, she doesn't know she's a character in a novel.
Yeah. She's smart, but not that smart. Yeah. I love her. And it's why? Oh, I was going to say, she's been described by some reviewers, I think, as harsh and cynical, maybe. And that, and I can see that on one level, but I don't think of that of her at all. I mean, she's harsh on a very superficial level, right? So she's probably no fun to hang out with because she is living in agony and she's hyper aware of it, you know, every detail of the agony. But I could also think, I would imagine people would see your novel, not just the narrator, but as eviscerating, because you're first of all sort of describing evisceration almost, the pulling out of the innards, like, you know, this what happened here with the mother during the C-section. I actually think it's the opposite. I think you're putting life back in. So it's like, there's a wall or a whole cathedral of silence, right, about all these things. And what she's doing, what your narrator is doing, to me anyway, is filling that cathedral, like every crevice, every crack with like details and colors and textures and smells and sex and piss and pus and vomit and all of it, you know, desire, lust. She's a full human being, fully realized.
Right. That can rub people the wrong way sometimes.
And that's what I was missing in Park Slope. That's what I was missing, talking to parents and just sort of observing them. I was thinking, aren't you human beings? You were human beings, you know, a while ago, a minute ago, and now all of a sudden it's all about diapers and mommy.
I mean, once you start to sort of cede to that, like, disembodiment, and you sort of start to say, like, somebody else is handling all of my sort of bodily stuff for me. I don't have to inhabit that, and I'm not qualified to inhabit that. You start down a path that I think is real hard to come back from. You know, you start to lose some real essential connection to, you know, I mean, it's all death, birth, bowels. Like, you know, there's an idea that, like, you know, in doula training, you know, we talk a lot about the mechanisms of birth and whatnot. And like, if somebody shone a flashlight in your face and a team of strangers stood around you in a cold antiseptic room and said, take a shit right now, Thad. You couldn't do it.
Not happening.
Right?
Not happening.
And they could yell at you all you want. They could threaten to cut it out of you. And like, you're not gonna take a dump. That's not how it works. You go to a nice little corner by yourself in a familiar place with some stupid magazine. And it works out just fine.
I was going to say, same with sex.
Exactly.
Except for the...
Have an orgasm right now.
Except for the very, very rare, extremely talented people known as porn stars.
Bless them.
Right? But it's rare. I mean, you know, if you talk to any porn director, they'll tell you that's the hardest thing is to find someone who can do that.
Not everyone can get
an erection or simply perform at any level, you know, in front of cameras and lights and all that.
Right. And we do the same business with death. You know, obviously the parallels are endless. Like, we make death into a more horrible experience than perhaps it has to be.
Because we hide it, right?
We hide it. We outsource it. We don't want it in our houses. We don't want to sit there with somebody for as long as it takes. We don't want to talk to them and hear them and cry with them. And, you know, we don't want to inhabit that space. It's just that physical stuff is just kind of a pain to think about.
And
or
what
something.
You're not directly experiencing becomes a new thing, a scarier thing.
Right.
Like people become scarier if you don't really know them, if you're not sitting in front of them. This mm-hmm. is why, this is one of the reasons I do in-person interviews. But things that you're going to go through, that are they going to happen that you don't know, you haven't touched yet, you haven't seen directly, become scarier and scarier.
Right.
So sex and death uh-huh. are two of the big ones, right? Things that we compartmentalize, put away, don't talk about.
Right.
And those become, guess what? Look at our culture. We're terrified of both,
uh-huh.
right?
Mm-hmm. And birth.
And birth, yes.
Right.
Those big three. That's right. And those are pretty important things. But yeah, I think the first word I had when I was reading your novel also to describe it was dark. And I'm sure a lot of people have used that term to describe it. I think that's partly right, but not really. Again, so to me, it's actually, it's a novel about light, you know, inside mm-hmm. her, inside all the feelings, all the thoughts, all the, as I said, desires, right?
Yeah.
You're filling this person up. You're filling the body up. You're giving the body back, in a sense. You're
yeah.
creating, and it's a full, I mean, she, it's so detailed, and you're sort of, my experience in reading it is like, I'm just sort of right next to her, you know,
yeah.
just right with every little move, every little thought, every little
yeah.
tremble or pain or.
I love that about fiction, that it can give you that, that like, that it can afford you a like a real window into another being's
It can.
Mind. Doesn't if, always.
If the writer is good.
Well,
so that's why I said that, because I've read many novels in which I don't feel that way.
Right.
So,
well, because, you know, writers often think that they can sort of bullshit, but writing is always smarter than the writer, you know? Writers who sort of want to hedge and think that they can sort of pull one over on a reader, like, you know, it doesn't work. Like, you go balls to the wall or you go
That's exactly
home.
What I said that to my producer, Paul, when we were driving up here. I said, this novel, she's just... I said, balls out. Just balls out the entire time. And I was thinking, that's kind of funny, you know, as a description.
Vulva.
Vulva
out.
Volving out. Yeah. There's another vibe or sensibility I get from it. And you kind of do reference it directly a few times, but it's punk rock. I find it to be very punk rock, although better, I think, at least in my opinion about than a lot of punk rock. And you kind of reference women bands in the... I guess it's, I don't like this, but the Riot Girl era, the post-punk or whatever you want. So I knew a bunch of people in that world. I was friends with Mia Zapata and the Gits.
You were?
Yeah, and this N7 Year Bitch and
wow.
those people. I mean, I wasn't ever really in that scene, but I went to college with them and I was friends with them. And
I love Mia Zapata.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So she was murdered,
I
for
know.
Those of you who don't know. But she was raped and murdered. But she was in a band called the Gits, and they were buddies of mine, and actually played in another band with a lot of those guys. But so I was around there, and I went to Seattle and hung out, and I sort of observed it. But I was never really a fan, I have to say. I loved the Gits, but I wasn't really a punk fan generally. And post-punk and Slater Kinney and all that, which you do reference, and it, pretty clearly you kind of had some connection there to that scene, right? And it's not just that you were around it, but it's the writing reminds me of Mia.
That's a beautiful compliment. Thank you. I mean, Mia and the Gits are sort of in a different league entirely from like Slater Kinney and whatever came later. I mean, it's hard to even talk about them in the same, you know.
I mean,
one's almost like a shadow of the other, you know, like a Xerox of a Xerox.
Why do you say
Xerox?
That?
I don't know. I don't know.
Cut my skin, it makes me human. That's a line from Mia,
mm-hmm.
which that's your novel, Cut My Skin, It Makes Me Human. And
right.
it's, she's talking about that feeling
yeah.
that no one talks about,
mm.
especially girls fronting rock bands, right? They don't talk about that, especially novelists writing about the American experience. They don't write that.
No.
Filmmakers, they don't show that, as you were saying, on TV shows, they don't show that.
No. No, I mean, punk rock was... all about, I mean, you know better than I do. I was a little too late for it. But, you know, it's about rejecting the systems that, you know, perpetuate the status quo and that tell us who to be or how to think or, you know, what's normal or what's right or buy this, do this, plug into this prefab, you know, lifestyle or... So what do I mean when I say that, like, some of the stuff that came later is, you know, has by now started to seem just kind of like corporate bullshit.
Oh, but not Slater-Kinney. I mean, they're not corporate, are they?
I don't know. I've sort of soured. I don't,
did oh, you read, soured
did,
on them?
Did you read Carrie Brownstein's memoir?
Oh, right. She was, I don't that like, was a, I'm not a fan of Carrie Brownstein.
She shit the bed hard. That was, wow.
But there was, and I,
I'm like afraid to say that she's like sacrosanct in the like sort of hipster culture. She's, she looks so cute on Instagram. Like,
yeah.
But, oy,
right.
No.
Yeah. So this is pre-hipster. You know, what we're talking
Slater
about
Kinney,
so
like when I was in high
they're,
school.
They're pre-hipster.
I loved them.
Like, I don't think the term hipster was even really used then when no. they started. But now, of course, they represent it. Okay, so now I know what you mean.
I so know when I was growing up, it was like Slater Kinney was badass. Like, you know, like Reality Bites was coming out. And like, Singles. Remember that movie? Singles,
yes. Uh-huh.
Bridget Fonda. Yeah. Oh, my God. I thought Bridget Fonda was just the woman. I thought if I just looked like Bridget Fonda, my life would be so good.
There was a, so it was associated really closely, that Riot Girl. I can't stand that because the way they spell it too. Was it G-R-R-R-L, whatever?
Well, see, but the problem is that it's just become something like what it was 20, 25 years ago and what it means now, like bear little resemblance.
I think that's, I think you're onto something there. Yeah, I think it's definitely different. And that's kind of what I'm getting at here, which is that when that happened, so we're talking about the early 90s through the 90s basically, right? The early stuff when the Gits were playing, when the Gits were doing their thing and Slater-Kinney and all that were starting. And the energy, so I didn't love the music, I have to say, but what I did love was the energy coming from often the singer, you know, the front person. And it was like, it's your narrator. It's like this relentless.
Yeah.
And it's in that punk clipped rhythm.
Yeah.
Where it's just bap. Bah, bah, bah. Yeah. That's kind of the rhythm of your
prose. There's no time for bullshit. There's no time for anything that sort of makes it a little more palatable. Like if you're not down for this, then like just go away.
Yeah, there's no time. That's right. And your prose is very, at least in this novel, it's very much like that. It's propulsive. It's constantly moving forward because I have more to tell you right now. And I love it. And it moves you through the book and it moves you through her head and it moves you through her life and her body. Yeah. And the energy, the driving force is this anger, which never kind of spills out, never becomes, you know, out of control. Really.
She never burns down the house.
Yeah. Or even, I mean, she sort of has what used to be called like a nervous breakdown kind of, but not really. I mean, there's no sort of like, yeah, explosion,
hysteria.
Loss of control, hysteria. Oh, there's a word for you.
There's a good one.
Yeah. But she is angry in every syllable, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. that seemed obvious to me, but yeah. But it's the same energy I saw in those early punk women punk bands. That was something new.
Right.
And I was going to say, so that the Riot Girl movement and those bands were
rolling your eyes even then.
And it's hard that they were considered at the time to be the cultural representation of this new wave of feminism. Mm-hmm. So that was like, when people talk about third wave feminism, mm-hmm. they often had in mind bands like that and
yeah.
punk and post-punk and all that. And that's different too now. And that's, I think your novel I think it's much more of that era in feminism than it is of the current feminism. What Ari's not asking for, I don't think. Maybe she is in some ways, but not. She's not. Let me ask you, since you wrote the book.
Since I'm here.
And you're here in front of me, and that's why I drove here. is she, I'm just thinking through this, is she, she's not seeking victim status. She's not asking to be saved, or
no,
is she?
No, I don't think so. I think that the anger and the articulation and the like attempts at self-awareness are an attempt to save herself,
yeah.
an attempt to like become this kind of warrior, this, mm-hmm. this kind of survivor, this kind of, you know, I'm going to take this fucked up experience and I'm going to like turn it into something that makes me stronger and that I learn from and that I can then sort of like change the world around me with, you know?
Yeah. I think that's my reading.
And it's true, you know, when you say like this current feminism, like, you know, I have gotten a ton of kind of like, I don't like this character because she's really judgmental of other women and like we can't judge each other. And
she certainly is.
Yeah. Which, you know, it's a real kind of weak-minded and convenient way of avoiding systemic problems mm-hmm. and avoiding looking at how we ourselves might be complicit in our own subjugation. Mm-hmm. And we might be complicit in systems that have no respect for us and that have no respect for our sisters and daughters. And it's a way of, it's that kind of individuality that you talk about, you know, it's that kind of like, I choose to outsource my birth and I don't want to be judged for it. It's like, you know, I don't give a shit what you do, but there's a really problematic system in place here. Yeah. And if you're not interested in dismantling it, you're part of it.
Yeah. That's the way we Americans think and talk about politics generally, including gender politics. Mm-hmm. So it's, here's a academic $10 phrase, I guess. Characterological individuation is what we do. So it's all about, it becomes, that was good, right? I got it out. It all becomes about, you know, who you are and what's wrong with you and why this person's bad. And that's the real problem. So, and the implication, although it's never even really stated, but the implication is simply, if we just replace that person, this will be better.
Yeah.
So we do that in politics, you know, Trump, the whole thing about Trump is all because of this guy and his fucked up personality.
Bullshit.
And he's a narcissistic. And so
which he is, but bullshit.
Sure, but the implication is we just replace him and then we get something and it's all better. So if you stop, if you woman, not women, right? It's woman, you woman, Ari in this case, stopped complaining and cutting these women down so brutally to their face and in your mind, we'd be better off, I guess. And then there would no longer be a patriarchy or sexism or a medical establishment that treats us like machines.
It doesn't pan out.
Not
that,
quite.
That line doesn't. Yeah, it's you can't really follow it through that line of thinking.
She is. What is she? I mean, I was actually looking through the dictionary trying to find words because none of them really worked for me. I can see people thinking of her as. Well, I mean, the obvious crude thing is bitch, whatever. But like vicious sort of doesn't really work entirely.
I grew up with Bitch Magazine, which was like a reclamation.
That was the Riot Club magazine.
I loved that.
One of
my
students at Barnard, that was her internship, was a bitch. Yeah. So what do you think? I mean, how would you describe
how would
that
I describe
personality?
Her?
Like,
what's, I don't know,
what is
I don't
that?
Know.
That the anger.
She's a full person. She is a human being with an entire spectrum of emotion. She's not estranged from herself. She's not afraid of her emotions. She feels entitled to express herself. And I think there's just some like really old, crusty, kind of basic. Resistance to that when it's a woman, you know, and even as we become more and more aware of it, it persists. It's like a woman who's not afraid of herself, a woman who doesn't apologize for herself, a woman who has the temerity to sort of think for herself, a woman who questions, like these things are still really far from being kind of okay.
I agree. I think I hate Hillary Clinton as much as anyone, but I do think it's pretty clear that she was treated differently and in a sexist way.
Yeah.
And I almost hate to say that because I hate her so much, but
yeah,
it's certainly in the first election in 2008, there was no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Like then it was clear as a bell. And I think part of it is that she's kind of mean, kind of tough, kind of what a lot of men are, you know, that's what being president is. It requires that kind of masculine toughness, which is a meanness, not just in that you are bad to people or violent, it's that you are narrow, right? You narrow human existence, narrow your feelings about things. That's not Ari either, though, right? She's not mean in that way.
I don't think she is. Some people seem to think she is and seem to be kind of really offended or sort of assaulted by her. Yeah, you know, or like, I couldn't even finish this book. She's awful, you know. You know, those are people who are looking for different things in a narrative. They're looking for an easy friendship. They're looking to feel better about themselves. You know, like I don't want that in literature. I want to come face to face with like all the sort of deepest, darkest truths like that anyone can muster, and maybe laugh a little bit too and roll my eyes a little bit too. But not everybody wants that. And not everybody's accustomed to that. So for somebody who's just kind of perusing, you know, a bookshelf and like, what am I going to take on vacation? I can see why she might feel like a punch in the face.
She's punching bitches in the face, like on every page, mostly in her mind though. Well, entirely in her mind.
Well, right. So that's the thing. Like somebody was saying, I don't remember at what point.
And she uses that term, by the way. That's not me. Just
I mean, somebody was saying like she hates other women, you know? And I was just thinking, it's kind of funny. Like, she doesn't, if you actually look at what her actions, like what she says to other people and what she does to other people,
right.
She's a perfectly decent person.
She's a good citizen.
Yeah. So, you know, and this
she
is
even volunteers at the co-op.
Right.
Which is probably based on the Park Slope co-op by any chance?
No, the Albany co-op.
Oh, damn it. I was hoping it was a local thing. Anyway. Yeah, she's saying very little, and what she does say is perfectly respectable.
Right. And so this is what always comes up in, like, when I teach writing and fiction and whatnot. Everybody, you know, at first is under this kind of funny assumption that, like, they should present, like, a really sanitized, noble, heroic kind of interior monologue. and it's really cute to watch people sort of struggle with this when they try to write, you know?
You don't tell them that, do you? You don't say, that's
no.
So cute.
Yeah, well,
as a
you're
teacher,
adorable.
I
just pat them on the head, yeah. But it takes a long time to sort of convince people, look, like, I want to know, like, what's inside you. I want to know the ugly shit that you're navigating. Don't try to sell me this bullshit that you don't have any, because you're just wasting your time, my time, everybody. Like, we're not here for that. That's not what this is for. Like, the idea that some of us don't have ugly thoughts is such an absurdity. Mm-hmm. And yet, when confronted with, like, ugly thoughts, even if they're artfully presented or crafted, I think that people who are not comfortable with their own tend to feel like this is really offensive.
Oh yeah. Like, I never thought of grabbing a woman by her pussy. Like, that's never, I mean, come on. I wouldn't, and certainly none of my friends.
What kind
either.
Of a monster?
That's never. Yeah. Come on. It's exactly. This is why I love your book so much. It's one of many reasons, but it's
people
just.
People are fucking assholes. We all are huge assholes.
Internally, at least.
Yes,
and
at
sometimes.
Least.
At least. We are having all the thoughts that Ari and Donald Trump are
right.
having, right?
But, well, the difference between, yeah. you know, I don't even want to talk
well,
about
she's
that
not the
motherfucker,
president.
But,
like,
you know,
sure.
like the difference between a real sociopath and like a basically decent person is that a basically decent person can sort of, like, roll with that interior model and say, like, oh, I'm being a bit, or oh, and like, and sort of be in dialogue and be on conversational terms with the ugliness in herself.
Yes, she's very fluent.
A true sociopath likes to believe that, like, they don't really need to engage any of their own ugliness.
Yeah. I was going to say, she's very fluent with her hatreds.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? She's,
yeah.
Now I was going to ask you about that. Like, hatred, that's a category. I would also use.
Hatelet?
She seems to be hating a lot of things and people.
Yeah.
And now that's not a sociopath. Sociopaths don't hate because, as you say, this is a line from your book, right? Hatred requires love.
Mm.
I'm not sure she loves these bitches on the faculty at the college where she's teaching who by
she's disappointed by them. I think her hatred and her vitriol in all the ways it's directed comes from feeling, you know, bereft and failed in this way and saying, like, why can't you be better? Why can't this be better? This shouldn't be this way. This is a letdown. I'm disappointed. I'm frustrated. You know, so it's like this process of coming to terms with how things are and how far from ideal things are. Like, these bitches on the faculty should be warm and inviting and take her in and hold her and take care of her baby for 20 minutes so she can go take a shower.
Right.
And, you know, yeah. like, things should be structured differently. So, you know, she's not necessarily the most mature yet, but I think this is part of, like, the journey, like, to sort of get to a better place of just, like, having to confront how not ideal things are. And that, like, rage comes up, you know, as Terminator said in Terminator 3, this was the epigraph to my first novel, anger is more useful than despair.
Huh.
You know, if you're just in despair, that's a static place. You can't do anything. There's no energy there. That's just fucking, you know, static.
It may be parallel to what my shrink told me once, which is that, what is it? Anxiety is the flip side of depression, or that.
Right.
That, in other words, or that what anxiety is you trying to stave off the depression,
right.
which is death, where there's no energy.
Right.
So the anxiety is energy.
Right.
So that's my game has always been anxiety. Like,
yeah.
That's my thing. And so I've always got energy and I'm always getting out of bed. The idea of, like, being, you know, stuck in bed with depression, right? I just never understood that.
Right.
My thing is to, like, lie in bed awake all night long for 10 nights in a row.
Oh, no.
But But
were you breastfed?
Anger. I knew you would ask that. How can you tell? Did you talk to my mother? I think I was.
What year were you born?
1965, they tell me.
Interesting.
I'm way older than you think.
Was your mom like a badass? Like,
yeah.
So maybe you were.
Yeah.
Because otherwise in 1965, they were selling that formula.
She was a badass sex positive feminist way before there was even really feminism of the second wave type. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And she still is. So yeah. Yeah. Plus.
So depression is the worst, right?
Oh, yeah. Anger is better than despair.
Because if you're anxious or you're angry, you're fucking up and at them. And you might not be, it might not be ultimately that productive, but at least you're hopefully finding your way somewhere that way. You're not just collapsed in a heap, useless to yourself, useless to everyone around you, you know?
Right. The other thing about anxiety is that it becomes anger often, right? Fear becomes anger. And then if that wells up a lot, it becomes rage. And I know nothing about that at all.
No.
But that's so I that's another reason I love Ari. And she doesn't express it or enact it the way that I did, which was to break things and shout at people. But she does, it's relentless, her expressions of anger, rage, fury at everything. She's pissed off at the bitches who treat her like a mother or only a mother, or the faculty who treat her like not a human being, which is, by the way, your send up or whatever, your description of academic culture. Oh my God. I hate them. I hate them. And there is something, you capture that sort of dehumanized robotic thing. That
right.
It took me a while to even sort of figure out that's what was going on. I didn't know why I hated this world and this culture, this way of dealing with people and talking, but that's what you helped me understand that actually, because there is a reduction of people to, you know, arguments. And you have that great line about politics too. And as a political person, I've been aware of this for a long time. And this is kind of the point of this podcast in some ways, is to kind of make political talk more integrated with the rest of our fucking lives and our feelings.
Yeah. This is all hugely political. And that's why I think it's so threatening.
As my mother told me way back.
What?
All politics is, everything is political.
Yeah.
Everything is political.
Everything is political. Yeah. Every fucking thing is political.
She did not say the personal is political. That's what the second wave feminist says. She said that everything is political, which I think is a much more radical idea. Everything.
100%.
And so that's why when I discovered gender analysis, like way back in the 90s when it was a new thing, I was like, I mean, I don't know exactly why, but I was totally, I called myself a gender-holic because I saw everything through a gender lens for a long time. How it structures the way we think and everybody and men and women. Oh yeah. I was going to ask you this. Speaking of that, men, am I the first male interviewer?
No.
How have men responded to it?
Well, I mean, I guess the men who've been able to approach it or embrace it or whatever have a lot of them have asked that kind of question though.
Oh, shit. You know, I retract. Edit this out.
It's okay.
Well, no, I'm wondering.
Like, or like, I'll get like, can men get anything from this book? And it's like, well, I don't know.
Oh, well, that settled for me. That's not my question. I think they should read it. And I think
men have responded. The men who, I guess if you're the kind of guy who's going to read this book, you're already sort of self-selecting
That's
as
true.
Somebody who's open to whatever's in it. But, you know, again, like I don't know how do women read Philip Roth? I guess that's an interesting question.
Right.
And I never cared about that. Like everybody used to give me such shit, like in grad school, like I loved Philip Roth. I was such a Roth fiend, you know, and everybody had their sort of people they identified with, you know, Robert Coover, take him or leave him, like, you know, whatever, whoever anyone was like obsessed with in grad school. And everybody used to just like, how can you like him? Like you're a feminist and you're this and you're that. And it's just like, it has nothing. I don't care what he's saying. I don't care who he is. I don't want to marry him. I don't care what it's like to live with him. I'm sure he's a shithead. Like, it's none of my business. I don't care. What I care about is he's a badass on the page. And his prose and his ideas and his fearlessness, that's what I want.
Fearless and honest and, Yeah, and it's pretty obvious if you know Roth that you're influenced by him. I mean, your prose, and not just your prose, but your honesty and your fearlessness are really reminiscent of him.
He taught me, man. I mean, he schooled me.
You didn't, actually.
No.
Right.
He came, actually.
Although he lives not far from here.
He did come to give a talk at Columbia when I was there. I did get
did
to sit
really?
Around a table, around like a seminar
I didn't know he
table.
Did that.
He did.
Wow.
And a friend of mine was his assistant for a little while. But she was a little terrified of him.
Yeah.
So I did get to sit around a table with him, and he, you know, I got to breathe the same air, and, but, you know, never meet your heroes,
yeah.
You know, never, ever.
Always disappointing.
I had lunch with Deborah Eisenberg once, and it was just a fucking travesty.
If you want to read the most graphic, detailed, unflinching description of you masturbating, read
mm-hmm.
Philip Roth,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, like every flicker in your mind of desire that leads you to touch your penis and stroke it until you ejaculate, every single step of the way, he will present to you in high definition.
The way that he was able-
And make you laugh.
Yeah.
And make you feel not ashamed. That's the beauty of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the opposite.
Right. And that's in all his fiction.
He's de-shaming.
There's no shame anywhere in it.
Well, it's taking the shame away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're doing too.
Have you ever read Shalom Auslander?
No.
He's another hero.
Huh.
He's fantastic. You would love him.
Interesting that you're all Jews.
Interesting. Interesting.
Is that, so you, I think you've even talked about this publicly. There's kind of a tradition that's been called the bad Jew tradition,
yeah.
Right? The outsider, I was kind of joking with you earlier about it, right? About being the immigrants, the outsiders, the unassimilated, the dirty, the obscene.
Yeah.
So pornography in this country was basically, that industry was founded by Jews,
right.
Jewish immigrants.
Hollywood.
Al Goldstein is kind of like the classic example of that. But the whole industry from the 1910s on was all Jews in this country. Hollywood, the more, you know, more respectable, but still, yeah, they were breaking rules in certain ways. And then Roth is very much a part of that because he, as we're talking about, he was talking about things like jerking off, but not just joking about it,
mm-hmm.
like presenting it to you, back
yeah.
to you in
yeah.
tremendous detail.
There's a lot of like, you know, I don't know, like where does that like sort of transgressive inclination come from? Is it like innate? Is it like a Jewish thing?
It's inborn.
Like, well.
We know that.
I mean, you know, I don't know. I can't speak for Roth.
Well, no, we know it's not actually, because I think you agree with me that there's fewer of you, the fewer of the bad Jews around. And,
right.
Right? Is that right, though? Am I right about that?
I don't yeah,
Louis
I know.
C.K.
I mean,
is part of that.
Is he a Jew?
Yeah, he's half.
No.
He's totally. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, he's either half or full.
I don't know. Wonder he's
his
such
father
a
was
fucking
weird. His
perv.
Father was. What's that?
I'm sorry, nothing.
What'd you say?
That's really inappropriate.
Say it again. Something
I said,
about
no
fucking.
Wonder he's such a fucking perv.
Oh.
I'm
right.
sorry. I'm sorry.
No. No, that's right. That's right. So when that came out, I was like, yeah, well,
see, there's
typical.
The kind of thing that like Jews can joke about. I talk about this with my son all the time. Like, I can say XYZ because I'm a woman and I'm a Jew. If somebody else were to say that, I would be really not cool with it.
So if I hadn't announced that I was a quarter Jewish, I would have already been in trouble.
I don't know. You kind of seem it. You kind of, I can say.
Really?
I
don't look at it all though.
What is that supposed to mean? No, just kidding.
Like a good American. What do you mean?
Okay,
obviously.
So I don't
square jaw. What do you mean?
Nordic
features.
I'm like really Jewish. I'm like a Jew.
Super Jew.
Like I was
Jew-ass,
I was
straight up
Jewishly educated like throughout. Like I mean like yeshiva and like
yeshiva.
Fucking
damn.
Yeah. My mom was like Baal Tshuva, like a born again Jew. And
what?
We were like
born again Jew.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. I have known about those people. Yeah.
So like I don't know.
Like in a formal way. She was born
yeah,
again.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I right. mean, like, we were synagogue going.
Because there's a lot of people who, like, you know, were raised secular, but
right.
then moved to Israel and
well,
became
more. That's Baal Tshuva, yeah.
Well, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
That's, like,
it.
Born again Jew.
It's a formal process. Got
right.
it, yeah.
You don't have to, like, do anything. Because, like, the thing about Judaism, like Jewish law, like, if you're Jewish, you can, like, convert. You can, like, claim Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior. You're still 100% Jewish.
Right.
There is nothing you can do
right.
as a Jew to not be a Jew.
Right.
Which is kind of amazing.
Well, because they need the people.
No, it's like, I mean, that's, like, old. There's, like,
right.
you know, if yeah.
So yeshiva. In
well, so.
And you're from L.A.
Yeah. So, like. I took Talmud. Like I learned how to like, and like, so there's something about that.
So your mom had done this before you were born?
She was going through the process.
She was born again before you were born.
It was like when I was little, Like, you know, Dennis Prager?
Yeah.
Dennis Prager used to lead these like workshops at this camp in Southern California that like families would go to. And it was like to get secular Jews like really into Judaism. It was like a kind of a, and Dennis Prager gave this talk to my young parents, who were then the parents of two little boys. And they said, do you want your grandchildren to be Jewish? And it was like this echoing question, like, well, yeah, but they will because we're Jewish. And it's like, no, they won't because assimilation is rampant. And if you don't live Jewish lives and have a Jewish home and like make this the center of your life, Judaism will disappear in this country. And it already is. And intermarriage is Hitler's wet dream and on and on and on and on and on. That's the kind of shit I was raised with. And anyway, but whatever. The point is transgressive.
Yeah.
Transgressive.
That's not whatever. First of all, that's
really a whole nother
important
thing.
Story though. Yeah.
So like fascinating. Talmud, I can connect it somehow to like my education was like, you ask questions about the questions, about the questions, about the questions. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I think I was like trained to think this way that like, there's nothing sacrosanct. Somebody tells you something, right. You question it 50 ways and then you question the way you're questioning it. Yeah. And then you, so like the idea that there's like some kind of just like wholesale received wisdom or information is not acceptable. There are no gods, there are no heroes, there are no, like nobody is sort of beyond questioning and nothing is anyway. So I don't know, that sort of transgressive spirit, like as it relates to Jewishness or Judaism, I
transgressive
think.
And intellectual in the best sense, right? Because intellectuals are just interested in questions, as you were saying, just asking. Rather than just having an answer and then proceeding from there. Yeah.
Or like refusing to sort of like be like, oh, okay, well, I'm satisfied with whatever that is. It's like, well, it's just like a game, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, it's fun. Like what happens if you keep questioning and you question that and you question whatever comes from that? And
right. And so when Jews, because Jews were stateless historically until 1948, they were always an outsider, well known, of course. Always essentially an immigrant.
Right.
Generally speaking, less assimilated, at least for a time, wherever they were. And this was, of course, the problem for them. And it was considered to be the problem that they had. But in many cases, it meant, certainly in this country, that they were the most transgressive people in some ways. So here, this tradition you're talking about of asking questions, of being the outsider, of being skeptical constantly led to the birth of American comedy.
It's like nothing is off limits.
Stand-up comedy was invented by Jews.
Right. Nothing is sacred. There's no prerequisite of belief. Nothing's off limits.
It was invented. I want to say that again. Jews invented American stand-up comedy. No, stand-up comedy. Forget it. There was no stand-up comedy anywhere else. They invented stand-up comedy. Blacks came right after that. And together they perfected that art form, but Jews invented that in vaudeville, right near where we're sitting, in fact, in the Catskills. Mm-hmm. But and that's, of course, comes right out of that tradition you're talking about. And then they're also distributing pornography, really, because that only, you know, the good Americans, the assimilated, not the assimilated, the good Nordic, you know, all American citizens, repressed, many secrets having Victorian Americans don't do that.
Also, Judaism, textually is super sex positive. I don't know about pornography. Not extramaritally sex positive, but yeah. Like in Judaism, what Judaism says about sex between between man and a white, like it's really sex positive.
Right. Well, there it's very procreative.
It's procreative, yes. But it's also pretty
talk about pleasure?
Radical.
There's pleasure
absolutely.
In there?
Absolutely.
There's pleasure in the Quran, by the way.
Yep.
If everyone should go read the Quran. When I taught the Quran at Columbia, and it was one of the things I was blown away by, that it's very sex positive. I mean, at least compared to the other major texts, the other religious texts. But and also, women do actually better in the Quran than they do in the Bible. Mm-hmm. It's not feminist, but there's some women's power in there, and there's some acknowledgement. I'm not sure of women's pleasure, but there's certainly acknowledgement of sexual pleasure, which, of course, you don't find in Christianity. That's the whole point of Christianity. Is to destroy the body and all of its pleasures to serve God. And that's exactly what you're driving a giant truck through, a giant Jewish truck right through that. that wall of silence. No, really. I mean, because it's like, and this is relentless, just like Roth did, you know, just, hello, you're not talking about these things, mm-hmm. people.
Right.
Constantly. And right. here's what you're not talking about.
Right.
The pain, the suffering, the pleasure, the joy, the lust, all of it. Your narrator, Ari, is, she's very sexual, which is also bizarre for a woman, a mother, excuse me, a new mother. You're not supposed to do that.
No. It's supposed to be the end, right? Like once you've procreated, you have no more need for any kind of sexual drive.
She wants to fuck, and that's the way she talks about it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she wants it more than her husband, which is also strange. Of course, he's not Jewish. Mm-hmm. An accident? I don't think so.
Coincidence?
So that's another radical thing. But what I'm proposing to you is that you are seditious, that you are... It's not even treason because you're not even being an American in a way. It really is an act.
Stateless.
It really is an act of sedition. You're not deliberately. It's not clear that you're deliberately trying to take down the civilization, but it would be.
Oh, I'm trying to take down the civilization.
Well, it'd be hard to argue that the book isn't serving that purpose, though. I mean that it is. If you're interested in upholding this civilization as we know it and have known it always. You can't really let this book stand. I mean, this is not okay because, as I said, it's like undercutting the foundation, the basis for it since the beginning, the nuclear family and the woman's place in it.
And women's silence and women's complicity and women's lack of agency over her own body.
Well, yeah. I mean, she's the mother, the Republican mother is what it was called. That was the invention, mm-hmm. the term after the revolution. Women were going to be the Republican mothers. They were going to create the good citizens, as I was saying earlier, you know, the good individual self-regulating citizens, which meant doing it on your own and doing it in particularly severe ways.
I taught this class last year toward a postmodern matriarchy, it was called. We started with Mary Wollstonecraft and all her stuff about, like, you know, if we educated women in a radical way, then we would have a new generation of radical thinking, like progressive people, because mm-hmm. like small-minded, terrified, you know, shut down people come from like small-minded, terrified, shut down mothers, you know, that given that like children's like formative years are spent under the control of the God that is mother, if you have a liberated mother, you're going to have a child who can really think for itself and who will be like powerful and happy and healthy in a way that a child of an oppressed, you know, the oppressed oppresses, so that an oppressed woman is going to treat her children like, you know, with a sort of a rule them with an iron fist and not allow them to sort of think freely or express themselves creatively. So like you can effectively oppress an entire generation if you keep their mothers oppressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's about how you define oppression and what particular kind of oppression. So the mm-hmm. way that we constructed this in this country is what has been called the great bourgeois silence. So we just don't talk about things.
Love
right?
that.
Right. The great bourgeois silence. Maybe I coined that, but I think I read it somewhere, which is, you know, the Puritan Victorian idea, yeah. right? We don't talk about sex. We don't talk about birth. Things we've covered already here. But then there's people who come along who talk too much. Those are the immigrants, in particular the Jews, but it's really all the immigrants.
Too
you just
loud.
talk. And the stereotype of the Jewish mother, of course, is the mother who talks too much, is too intrusive, too mm-hmm. controlling, too present, too motherly in a way.
Emasculating.
Yeah. And so that, we are led to believe, produces what?
Neurotics.
Neurotic comedians.
The Roths,
and pornographers.
The Woody Allens. Perverts. I mean, like.
And Elisa Albert. Yeah.
Men who want to just jerk off in front of anyone and
apparently,
everyone at any time.
We haven't even mentioned Harvey Weinstein yet.
Ugh.
So he, I mean, yeah, they're pretty much upholding that good old stereotype.
I'm so glad Trump's not Jewish. I mean, it, like.
He kind of is, though.
Small mercies.
No, but he kind of is.
No, but I mean, he's, you know.
He's black and gay also, by the way. He is. He's the first. No, really.
He's a queer.
He's the first.
Clearly.
Yeah, yeah, seriously. He's the first black president for sure, but I think he's queer too. And there's some Jewishness too. Anyway, we don't have to go down that road.
Let's not.
We don't have enough time for that.
Yeah,
no, but was your mother that stereotype? Was that the
what,
thing that was going on?
No.
Okay.
I think my mother, I think it goes back. I mean, it's hard to talk about my mother without talking about her mother and without talking about her mother, you know?
You don't have to talk about
no,
all
because,
the women,
because
do you?
I think that
I think that if we're not like uniquely able to like break the chain or whatever, that like what gets handed down from us, and this is genderless and this is mm-hmm. just human, what gets handed down to us sort of directs us and shapes us and determines like who we are. And like, I think Ari here is trying to say like, no, like this stops with me. And that's where I think she's heroic, yeah. you know, yeah. and that she is not a bad mother, you know, although, you know, on the surface, okay, hmm. she's, you know, she's bitchy. She's in a bad mood.
Well,
she's frustrated.
Fantasies about crushing her child's skull too.
No, she's terrified of it. It's
That's interesting that that's what you intended, but that could be read. I read it as simultaneously a fantasy and a fear.
Yeah, I don't know. It seemed to me like a PTSD kind of like okay. like an unbidden image that she was like, oh, fuck, like, what is that?
Or a shrink would say it's a wish that is expressed as a fear.
Yeah, all right.
Or experienced as a fear.
All right. So, but which meanwhile, she comes from this long line. But like maternal line, the maternal grandmother and the mother totally destroyed, right? In their different ways.
Right. So Ari is, right. So there's a nuclear family, which isolates us all, mm-hmm. puts us on this island and makes us raise these narcissistic dictator motherfuckers, I think mm-hmm. is your phrase for children, for babies, which I love so much. But also in her case, she's particularly isolated because her mother's dead. And,
right. and her mother was a bitch.
And mother was a bitch. Stepmother is useless and uninterested. Dad's useless and uninterested and all that. So,
but so her mother was like really cold, shut down, like totally right. disembodied, mm-hmm. cut off from the entire maternal experience as it's embodied, you know, no like quote unquote nurturing, like not mm-hmm. anything that we now understand to be kind of important for like psychological and emotional development. The safety and sort of comfort and
nurturing.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, like look at how infants were, you know, birth and maternity care in this country, even in the last 50 years, like it's terrifying. Like babies taken from their mothers directly after birth, put in isolettes in a room, not touched.
So there's a really delicate line though, between nurturing and suffocating.
Right.
So where is that line?
Oh, good question. It's right here.
We haven't even mentioned something, by the way.
What?
Which is, I think, most interviewers' first question, so I'm really proud I've waited this long. You are also, of course, a mother. And so you have firsthand experience here. And where do you, you don't have to talk about this if you don't want, but like what, where do you try to draw that line or based on your own experience rather than just thinking about your mother or theoretically about it?
It's like a process. It's like a living thing, you know?
I have no idea. I mean, I've been doing it for 16 years. I still have no idea.
Yeah, it's like what Jimmy Carter said about pornography, you know? You know when you see it. Like, right. like I try to be really self-aware and conscious as a parent. And if I feel like I'm, you know, doing too much, I try to pull back. And if I feel like I'm, you know, being neglectful, I try to cuddle up. And if I feel, and I, it's like the kid tells me, basically, it's like if I'm attuned to the kid and if I'm respecting his humanity, then I know what to do. He tells me what he needs. He tells me, you know, mom, leave me alone. Mom, come hang out with me. Mom, you know,
yeah,
it's hard.
It's so hard. It's the hardest thing. I don't understand. I never know. I'm just always flailing in the dark.
But see, that's probably a good thing. I mean, if you said I'm a great dad, I know exactly what to do all the time, I'd be worried about
oh,
you.
God.
You know?
Yeah, no.
I think humility is like...
I'm really smart. I know a lot of stuff. I have a lot of really good arguments about a lot of shit. I am a fucking moron. Not a moron, but I'm just... I feel completely ignorant.
Oh, my God. I saw this
at
movie.
At sea when, if with parenting.
You got to watch this movie. Yeah. I watched it a couple weeks ago. It came out of nowhere. I just sort of... I was looking for something to watch, and there it was, and I'm kind of have a weakness for Ben Stiller. I'm sorry.
I used to like you.
I'm sorry. I don't.
That hurt.
I know. I'm sorry. It's just, it goes way back.
Keep going.
It's
just finish.
I don't need to know anything about him as a person or his politics or his relationships. But he's in this movie, Mike White. You know Mike White?
Mm-mm.
He does really interesting stuff. You'd know him if you saw him. He's a character actor too, and you'd know him. He's a funny looking dude. He wrote and directed it. It's called Brad's Status.
Never
I highly recommend that you watch it like tonight. It's about a dad and a son. It's really.
Oh, really?
Fucking beautiful. Maybe because like, you know, when like you watch a movie with no expectations mm-hmm. and it blows you away because you haven't seen a preview. You're not, you know, I thought that movie was breathtaking.
Why would I like it?
It's about a dad who's not a perfect person and who doesn't have his shit all the way together and who's still confused and still not always like on the up and up with himself. And he's taking his son on a college tour, and his son is like pretty awesome and well-adjusted and kind of smarter and cooler and, you know, than his dad. And it's about the dad character sort of coming to like have a moment of grace. Like the entire movie is sort of building toward this incredibly beautiful, I have chills right now, like subtle moment of grace that this man achieves. And maybe it's not going to last and maybe it will, but like, I just thought it was a home run of a movie.
Sold.
Done.
I will do it tonight. I promise.
Tell me what you think.
Totally. Back to your mother.
Okay.
How was that for a segue? I'm a trained interviewer. Were you saying that she didn't nurture? She was on the other side, of the other I end think, of what the Jewish woman is supposed to
yeah,
be?
Yeah, I think she was a victim.
But was that how it came out, that she was not
She had a hard time. I don't think she knew how to take care of herself, and I don't think she knew how to take care of other people, and I don't think she knew which end was up, and I think she was a victim of a lot of fucking bullshit, and I think
what do you
she
mean?
Was...
What bullshit?
Well, when she gave birth to her three children, she was... the first one was 1969, then 1972, and then I was 78. And she was given three routine...
blaming the doctors again?
You know, blame the culture, the system. She was, in those days, what was standard. If you were a healthy woman with a healthy pregnancy and you were privileged, I mean, she went to Cedars-Sinai in LA to have her baby. She was a very privileged woman with the best care.
Yeah, you can also go to war in the best tank.
Absolutely. Best uniforms, shiniest buttons.
And those little Arabs can still blow you up.
Exactly. So anyway, she, you know, in those days, okay, so standard protocol 1969, you go into a hospital, your husband is somewhere else. You are shaved, you are given an enema, you are given a full episiotomy, which means they cut your perineum completely.
Yep, I saw it.
And the doctor goes in with forceps.
Shocking moment for me. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, totally unnecessary.
And that was the least of it, right? That's just the beginning in a way.
That's
the snipping of that piece of flesh. Yeah, my God.
Right. Interestingly, this is another topic. I'm sorry. I have so much to say on this. But in California, there was just a landmark case, huge deal in the birth justice community. A 24-year-old woman having her first baby, healthy woman, healthy pregnancy, healthy baby. California hospital, Southern California. Her mom is videotaping it, and doctor's a total schmuck. She's screaming, she's pushing, baby's doing fine, she's doing fine, baby's coming out. And doctor comes in and says, I'm gonna cut you now. And she says, no. Doctor says, don't tell me what to do. I'm the doctor, I'll do whatever I want. She's screaming, no, no, don't cut me, no. Doctor goes right on ahead. Baby's born, baby's fine. You know, everybody survives, but it was on video, right? And she contacted this incredible organization, Human Rights and Childbirth, based in Oregon, amazing lawyer named Hermine Hayes Klein, who runs it. She's fantastic. Anyway.
I heard about this.
You did? Well, so they approached 62 civil rights lawyers with this case, and they were turned down because mother's alive, baby's alive. What's the problem?
Right.
Nobody's dead.
It's a cultural question. It's not a legal question.
But finally, they did find a lawyer to...
I mean, you can win those battles for now, but it's a... Right, you would agree.
But this
it's
is
a cultural question.
This is a landmark case. There was not a case before this where somebody successfully sued. The doctor lost his license.
Sure, fine. That's great. I'm all for it. I'm just saying that what's going to change that more effectively, I think, and probably more quickly and more comprehensively, is books like yours.
I hope so.
Well, that's the point, right? I mean, you're trying to get this into the consciousness and change people's minds. But you changed mine. I didn't even think we were going to talk about that.
What, like birth justice?
The medical establishment, the politics of it at all. I didn't think that was going to be part of this conversation. And I didn't know a lot of what you told me. And I consider myself a fairly, you know, sophisticated, up-to-date guy
you
on a
seem
lot of
like
stuff
a
like
fairly
this.
Sophisticated
yeah, I kind of am. But you kind of schooled me in the
Ooh.
Best way. Yeah, totally. And in the best way. And I'm curious and I don't know. And just the fact that I really didn't know even the history, and I'm a goddamn historian,
totally.
Right, tells me that there's a lot of cultural work to be done. At least
a lot.
Questions.
A lot.
I don't know if I would agree with you if I did all the research, but at least we got to ask the questions.
Totally.
Kind of like your people apparently have done for a long time.
And let us say amen.
Yeah. Last question, and I know you get this question a lot too, but I'm just going to ask it anyway, even though it's probably cliched for you by now. But so I, in doing this podcast, you probably gathered this by now, talk about a lot of personal stuff having to do with people in my life who are very close to me, including my son. And I have talked about him a lot less in recent months on the show, but in the first few months I talked about him a fair amount, and I kind of got into trouble.
With him?
Yeah. So he's 16. Your son is 9.
Yeah.
And you wrote the book when he was young, right? When he was a young child?
He was about 1 when I started it.
And of course, it has nothing to do whatsoever with your own life and him at all. But he might, when he becomes a teenager, because he's too young probably to really do this, go there. But when he's a teenager, I'm kind of warning you, there's a good chance he's going to find out something about what you had to say about being a mom, at least through your character, through your narrator, and it could cause some issues. And I'm just telling you, it's an actual issue with me right now with this show, with this thing I'm putting out there. And I don't know how to handle it. And I don't know if I should just stop talking about him. That's kind of the policy that I've taken recently.
Yeah, or just be vague, or just be kind of, you know,
I feel like either you're going to talk about it or you're not, you know, I don't want to just make suggestions or implications and then not really go into it.
Well, may I recommend fiction?
Please.
Fiction fiction is a useful tool for things.
I've been thinking about that. I want to write some fiction.
You can talk about whatever you want in fiction. And even if people make assumptions about what's true or what's not, like only you know, only you and the people close to you know.
But to even have the ability and willingness to say what you say through your character suggests that you are at least conscious of and respectful of the hatred of being a mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think a novelist has to be like a really good actor and also kind of like a student of human nature, so that like there's no, what did Henry James say? It's a really good line. It's really famous. I am human and nothing human is alien to me. In the way that like I'm not always talking about myself. I might be throwing a thing or two in or taking something I think I know about and kind of twisting it or reflecting it or funhouse mirroring it or whatever. But it's really more about like, can I like inhabit this character? I mean, even stand-up comedians are sort of playing a role, sure. Right? Mm-hmm. Like we think we know who Chris Rock is, but you know, only the people in Chris Rock's family know who Chris Rock is. You know, it's like we know his persona. So I'm almost like projecting this. I'm kind of like fronting, you know? It's really fun.
Yeah, but she hates being a mother. She hates this.
In this moment, she does. Like, it's a 3-month snapshot.
She hates every moment.
I think she I think she hates her circumstances. I think she's in a place where she doesn't feel connected to her husband. She has no friends.
Oh, she's not making any universal claims outside of her own experience, but she's hating every second.
She's having a miserable, miserable time right now. And what's funny is, of course, like there was no mention of, quote, postpartum depression in any of the marketing materials. I made quite sure of that. And yet every professional and amateur reviewer alike made sure to diagnose her, which I thought was funny and telling.
And the way you handle that in the book is you sort of just slap in the textbook definition, basically, of postpartum depression, and then continue with your narrative, basically, to me. I took that as like...
We've always loved to diagnose women.
I just love it when people diagnose me with stuff using the textbook. I love it when people apply a psychological textbook to me. Right. That's my favorite thing. Right. It's really enlightening. It makes me feel better, too.
It's really funny. And it's sort of like part and parcel of this culture where it's like, oh, I've put my finger on like what you are, like now you need to like take this drug or do, you know, I mean,
or whatever the answer is, they have it and you don't. I mean,
you are entitled to my opinion.
Yeah, this is why everyone should read Foucault, right? We should all start there and we'll know.
What if everybody read Foucault?
Well, I would love it if people who talked about Foucault would read him. That would be that's my first goal. That's what I'm working on now, is getting the people who are running around ranting and raving about how Foucault is bringing down civilization, how he's the devil and a Marxist and a you name it. And it's pretty clear they've never actually cracked one of his books. But of course, he began his work with this critique that you and I are clearly influenced by. of the medical establishment mm-hmm. and the psychological establishment in particular, which diagnosed people, mm-hmm. essentialized people, reduced people and their experiences to this thing, this illness, this pathology, and then prescribed medicine for it. Or confinement.
Oh my God, the history of women and like psychological diagnoses is fascinating. Barbara Ehrenreich, one of her earlier mm-hmm. works was For Her Own Good, amazing mm-hmm. book. And yeah. Deirdre English, 200 Years of the Expert's Advice to Women. Did you know that women are most often admitted to mental hospitals during the luteal phase of their menstrual cycle, aka PMS?
Mm-hmm.
That's funny.
Yeah. They right after the nation was established, in all the cities, there were these reformatories in Philadelphia, New York, Boston. And those were for women who were deemed by a court, by a judge, to be either promiscuous or actual prostitutes. Mm. The point being that they weren't really interested sufficiently in being mothers.
Right.
And so they were put into these reformatories where they were taught mm-hmm. how to be a mother. And more importantly, much more importantly, and this is Foucault's great insight, that to not have that desire, that instinct, right, was bad, and they should mm-hmm. feel bad about it mm-hmm. and do everything they can to recover it, mm-hmm. recover the maternal instinct that they had somehow lost, either through circumstance or bad choices on their own part, but that it was unnatural and a sign of real mental, characterological
yeah.
flaws.
And I see an undercurrent of that in so much of what people have told me about my own book.
And they kept them there.
Right.
It was prison. This was prison. This was, you know, the cops would take them there and lock the door and leave them there.
They're dangerous.
And teach them until they were sufficiently able to be mothers and wives also. Right. So, yeah. How is that relevant to your book?
Even to sort of narratively, fictionally address a character's unhappiness with her place in culture and society and her role to play and her lack of support in having to play that role is to sort of like bring on this like wave of sort of like diagnoses and like kind of accusations and like, well, she hates being a mom or she's a bad mom or she's this or she's that. It's just like, you know, if you actually look in the book at like how she's taking care of this child, like what her actions are, not what the internal monologue is, not what she's struggling with, but how she's actually living her days, she's taking very good care of her child and she's trying very hard to like love the child and to do what the child needs and to, you know, make sure that the child does not suffer any of her struggles.
It's the fear that's the worst part maybe of her experience, which even us fathers who care experience to some extent, a great extent, you know, it's the constantly checking for the breathing because you're sure the kid's going to die if you turn your back literally or just walk out of the room. They're going to die. I have a friend who just had his wife just had a baby just 2 months ago, and he's checking the breathing like every five minutes all night long.
That's got to be like encoded in our DNA.
No, this is what I'm going to tell you. So I'm a historian and I'm here to tell you, here's the really good news.
What?
That we didn't always think this way about children. We didn't always care about them this much and in this way.
Well, we used to have more of them.
We had more of them, and so we couldn't.
Yeah. I mean, when you have one, it's kind of a recipe for overparenting.
Yeah, but I think the historians of parenting, childhood, families, like Ehrenreich, like Kuntz, Claudia Kuntz, and others have, I think they're pretty much a consensus that there was simply less of this constant obsessive fear that we're going to damage the child. I think that's a new thing.
Yeah.
I think that, and Art is very much suffering from this. She's constantly terrified, not afraid. She is terrified.
Yeah.
The kid's going to die. She's going to be responsible or something. Or beyond that, that she's going to somehow damage the kid psychologically. It's going to last forever.
Which is not coincidental, which has a lot to do, I think, with how alienated and estranged she is from a matrilineal support system.
I think that's probable. So I'm all for the extended family, and I'm all for destroying the nuclear family and burning it and burying it immediately. But all I'm saying here is that this is, I think, a new thing. Like, I suffered it. I don't know if you did, but like all of my friends did, male and female.
Yeah.
Were constantly terrified. The first thing I did when my son came out was I counted all of his fingers and toes rather than think, wow, this is great, or celebrated, or yay. It was like, is he okay? Because I just assumed something was going to be wrong and I'd have to spend the rest of my life taking care of some damaged, deformed creature.
Wow.
And then I, from then on, once I figured out that he had all of the digits, then I was just sure he was going to die.
Right.
Until he was about 5. And even now, of course, I still, he's 16. Of course, I'm constantly worried still. It's not quite as intense, but it's a new thing. It's our generation.
Or well, I think
my generation, and then you're the next generation.
There's also something about, like, you know, I think it's all connected.
Don't you think it's a response to what our parents' generation did?
I think that it's a response to being kind of stripped of our instincts, like systematically told that, like, we don't know how to do. I mean, you know, even look, if you're 17 years old and you're getting married and you start to have babies right away and you have a whole mess of babies, you're going to lose a couple. That's par for the course. That's everybody, right? And you grew up watching your mother have babies and watching your sisters have babies and watching, and there's a life cycle happening in front of your eyes all the time. People are getting old and dying. People are being born. What's happened, I think, here and now is that everything's gotten sort of stretched out, right? Nuclear family bullshit, estranged from the whole process, the whole life cycle. Can I get pregnant? Number one.
Yeah.
Does my body work?
That's the first fear.
Right?
Yep.
Okay. So you're stripped of that instinct. Mm-hmm. Like, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm pregnant. Oh my God. What to expect when you're expecting? That book is the biggest pile of trash.
I remember it well.
What to freak the fuck out about when you're expecting, like how not to trust this process at all, how to like be afraid of every So there's at every turn, there's this systematic sort of stripping us of our kind of instinctive well-being. We're mammals. Like we know how to do this. Our bodies work most of the time. And we're older, right? Mm-hmm. We're 30, we're 35, we're 40, we're fucking Janet Jackson, 59. We're like, whatever the fuck. We've paid $700,000 to engineer this offspring. We are being monitored, you know, and then of course birth. And then you're lying in a bed, you're this assumed state of helplessness. You're not moving. You've been numbed from the waist down so that God forbid you don't feel any of this. Other people are coming in and telling you what's happening to your body. You can't feel your fucking body, so you have to be told how to push. Mm-hmm. You don't need that when you're squatting, when you're surrounded by people who know exactly what this is and who aren't afraid of it, you know. And oh, can you breastfeed? Oh, here, have some formula. Now you know how much the babies get. So every turn, none of this is a coincidence. It's all designed to make us helpless, scared, and fucking useless.
So I think our theories connect, though. I think that whole apparatus and all of that's correct. I agree with you and everything there. I remember my ex-wife being hooked up to all these tubes just to get the milk out. I mean, it was just ridiculous. But I don't think we'd have that apparatus if we didn't make the children sacred.
Right. Well, I think children are sacred. I do.
Well, they can be if you want them to be, right?
I think life is sacred.
Okay, then everything's sacred and then the children are no longer different than anything else. But, you know, I mean, come on, you know that this is a thing in our culture that we have this particular, in this moment historically is my point here, this particular, whatever you want to call it, we have this obsession or this view, this feeling that's deep, it's almost encoded, right, that they must be protected by us all the time and that we are always basically guilty.
Right.
And that we're going to be discovered at any moment of being guilty of having the feelings that Ari has, and that is going to result, the feelings that are secret are going to result in the death of our child. I think that whole thing is the fear I think that I had about my son dying in his crib.
You're talking about like the evil eye right now. This is like deeply like mystical, the superstitious.
The death of the son, I think, actually is less powerful. And that's the less of a fear than the fear of the shame of being the dad who let his son die. Mm-hmm. So everyone should think about that. Which is scarier to you, being known as the dad who let his son die or who did something that caused the death of his son, or just the death of the son or the daughter? Right? I mean, certainly they both come with powerful.
It's all unbearable.
Punishment, yeah.
I mean, and part of the fear that's instilled in us and the systemic sort of stripping us of our birthright and human rights and instincts and sort of mammalian like intelligence is based in that fear. The threat, the implicit threat is always like, you're going to give birth at home. You want your kid to die.
Right.
You're going to like breastfeed. You want your kid to starve right. to death. You're going to leave your conception up to chance.
Right.
Like you're, you know, that's reckless.
Because we go to war for the most important things. We only go to war for the most important things. And when we go to war, you don't want like homemade tanks. You don't want amateurs driving, flying the planes. You want a fully professionalized force.
I don't know. There's probably good stories of like, so, of like native savage armies defeating the best and the brightest of military
sometimes,
science.
Occasionally. But right, if you're really at war,
I want the dude who like can navigate by sniffing the air. I want the dude who can like
win.
Walk barefoot on the earth and tell you if it's gonna rain. I want like, yeah. No, I don't want to go to war in the first place at all.
No, neither do I. That's my point here. So I'm saying we're making the cause of childcare, of parenting, equivalent to the cause of, you know, the greatest wars in human history for the things that are, you know, so necessary, so justified that, you know, they were right.
No, but P.S., like, isn't always war about just improving, like, isn't war always just about money for science
I'm
and technology?
I have never found a war that I would fight for, that I would fight in, that I support. This is my point. This is a Foucauldian point, that the ideology, that people's feelings about it, thoughts about it, constructions about it are powerful, and they think, many right. people obviously think, well, I got to go way overseas right. to kill those
right,
people
right,
because
right.
the cause is so important.
It's righteous.
Just like the life of a child.
Right, right, right.
The life of a child is equivalent to whatever, you know, the Holocaust or something, or stopping the Holocaust or whatever it is, whatever the cause of the moment is that's sacred and just and holy, right? It's that powerful. I think it's really, so it's, you can be the guy or the woman who it lets everything down, everyone down. You failed in your most basic function,
well,
which is
it,
to protect.
Is it you or is it like
to
biology?
To protect and serve. Yeah, I don't buy that.
Like if a child dies of SIDS, like have you failed or does nature sometimes
sure.
claim
well,
life?
You, I don't think you failed in any sort of objective sense, but we certainly feel,
well,
right. many of us, most of us would feel like we failed.
I mean,
not as much as if we, you know, put the pillow on the child's face and then put a heavy book on top of the pillow. No, but like, sure. I mean, I think there's still, you know, you're going to live for the rest of your life as the person who lost the child.
God forbid. I think that as we like succeed more and more and more in like sort of hammering nature and controlling it and feeling like we are in charge and nature's our bitch, the less sort of conversant we are in some of the basic stuff that our predecessors probably were able to handle a little better. Like sometimes children die and sometimes things don't go right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've bested nature, right? But now we're so terrified and we're so helpless. And it's like, if technology doesn't like work the way it should, we don't know how to deal with Jack.
Mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda and ISIS are super duper duper scary. And so we have to have the biggest, baddest military, most professional fighting force ever. We have to have an overwhelming, perfect military force to kill them, to destroy it, to win that victory. And same thing with kids. It's like, it is so important. My God, this is the most important thing in the whole wide world. So we must professionalize, have this whole apparatus, this...
Right. Well, even as the data, even as like our...
To make sure it's right, to make sure it's good and they're protected.
Our logic is useless because we know if we look at the evidence that actually isn't true, that you know, women and children in this system do not fare well. They don't fare as well as women and children in systems that are a lot less invasive.
Mm-hmm.
We know this. It's inarguable. It's there, you know?
Well, I do know that. The hospitals, American modern hospitals now are killing tens of thousands of people that shouldn't be killed. I mean, shouldn't die every year. It's something incredible. It's an incredible number. Yeah. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Did we finish?
No, I think it's fairly endless.
I think so too.
It's because it cuts right to the heart of so many dynamics and so much history and so much of this culture. I mean, like it's kind of the white hot center of a lot.
You never answered my question though.
Which
I realized
one?
So you're not worried about your son reading what you
no.
are at least in touch with?
No, no.
Okay.
I mean,
good. I hope not. I mean, I hope there's no reason to worry.
No, I'm not worried at all. I don't think, No, I don't think there's an issue there. He's a really cool, funny. He's got a kind of a twisted sense of humor, and he gets a lot of stuff. He's really, and I'm super honest with him about everything. I talk to him about everything, and he knows what all my writing's about or what I'm working on or what he's like, you know, he knows what I do as a doula, and he knows, like, you know, he's part of everything. He's like privy to every conversation, and he's pretty savvy. I mean, I'm knocking on wood because I'm a superstitious old country.
Oh, really?
Reincarnation is some kind of like shtetl,
yeah,
witch. But
that's interesting, shtetl witch. You would be called that, certainly. A doula, I don't know, there's probably another Jewish doula.
Yenta. I mean, I think like the
yep.
Yeah, I don't know.
In everybody's business, wanting to control things.
No. I don't want to control anything.
You think you know live better? And let live. You think you know better than the doctors?
Live
don't
and
you?
Let live.
So this podcast is about, you know, things you're not supposed to say, and, you know, I've had on let's see, drug dealers, criminals of various kinds, prostitutes, wow, gay porn stars, fascists,
wow,
anarchists. And I absolutely believe that your book is the most renegade, unregistered of all. I mean, really, it's
high five.
It's, seriously. Damn. It's the most radical thing I've read in a long, long, long time.
I'm really glad. And I'm going to keep on keeping on.
Yeah, and it's not about killing or eviscerating. It's about filling in, and it's not about darkness. It's about shining a light. I hate this as cliche, but it's like showing, exposing, demonstrating, talking about
catharsis.
Thank you. Yeah, that's the feeling I get. It's the feeling catharsis I get from reading your book.
You can't get catharsis by just kind of like tiptoeing around. It doesn't work that way.
The catharsis, you know, when you have this really powerful emotional experience, is like afterward you sort of feel just drained, but in a good way. And that's kind of how I felt, honestly.
I'm so glad
reading your book. No, really, there's a really powerful feeling that you get from it. It is catharsis. I love it. And I do think it could break at least a chain, you know. Yeah. It is so different and so radical, and I think in a really important way.
I hope it like kind of fits into a big body of work that like all kind of aims to sort of do.
Speaking of which, and this will be the last question, I promise.
Okay.
What is the next book?
It's about a singer-songwriter doing a lot of work still with, like, you know, music is like, if I had been able to play music, I wouldn't have become a writer, you know, that would have been like the ultimate. But it's about a singer-songwriter who's like starting to experience some success and like despises it and like despises any kind of fame or intimations of fame or whatever, has no time for any of that, and would really like to have a child. Mm-mm. But is seeming unable to have a child, but has a deep, resounding, ferociously angry resistance to anything to do with assisted reproductive technology.
Uh-huh.
So that's the next kind of takedown. Like the fertility industry mm-hmm. is going down with the next one.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
You are a shtetl witch, aren't you?
I just like to tip those sacred cows. I just like to, like, what would piss people off the most? What if I go after their fucking IVF? What if I start, like, picking off the twins in the neighborhood? I'm gonna get a lot of shit for that. Let's go. Let's do it.
I love it. I love the spirit. I mean, that's why I'm here. That's why I drove to Albany. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thank you. You're welcome. Cool.
This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To sign up for the Renegade University webinars, visit thaddeusrussell.com/courses. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredlisteners.com. Thanks for listening.